Welcome to the Fatigue Super Conference. And this is a bit of a different recovery story. And it's different for a few reasons. It's different partly because I think it's a theme that we probably haven't covered at Optum Health Clinic in the way that we're going to cover it today. But it's also a bit of an unusual one because it's my sister-in-law that I'm talking to. So hello, Violet.
Hi.
it's kind of interesting because, of course, I should try to be professional in my manner. But of course, you and I do know each other rather well. But this is I think it's an interesting story as well, because from my point of view, it's probably the recovery story which I've been the most involved in, apart from my own recovery story. And that'll probably become clear as we come into it a bit more. But it's been interesting, obviously, from my point of view, having been someone that's had chronic fatigue and recovered, having been a practitioner working with lots of people and training lots of practitioners, to also be in the role of having a family member that has been going through their own journey as well. And I like to think I was helpful at certain points, but I think I was probably unhelpful at certain points.
You were very helpful
to that as well. But the kind of main theme that we're going to explore with these recovery stories as part of the conference, we're having done dozens and dozens of recovery stories over the years. What we're particularly focused on here is pulling out some of the key themes that can be important along the recovery path. And for this story, we're going to look at the role of creativity. Having a creative outlet, having a creative connection, a creative passion. And Violet, now kind of coming through the other side of this whole experience, works as an artist, and I have been a beneficiary of this artwork at various points over the years in the evolution of it as well, but has a staggering talent as an artist, and she'll get embarrassed me saying that. Mm-hmm. But it's really, if it hadn't been for Violet's journey with a fatigue-related condition, I'm not sure you would be on this path that you're on now. So it's also one of the gifts, or one of the things I think has come from that journey. Should we go back to the start, though, in terms of where this story started? So I know that even before you started having much more immediate kind of obvious signs of what was happening, you'd had some struggles in terms of energy at times prior to that.
Yeah, I had. So I'd been working quite hard in the run-up to me getting sick, and I'd been exercising hard. I'd just been doing too much. I'd been pushing my body in a lot of ways, and I'd been having a few symptoms here and there, but I didn't pay any attention to them. I kind of ignored them, thinking this is normal or I'm just a bit tired. So I'd normally come home from work and have a little nap before going out for dinner, whatever it was. And I just kind of carried on going and carried on pushing until the symptoms just got so much worse and started screaming out.
And you were working in a pretty stressful job at that time. You were teaching parenting classes in an underprivileged part of London with some quite difficult caseloads that you were working with, right? So that was also a pretty demanding kind of day-to-day life.
Yeah, it was really, really stressful. So it was sort of frontline social work with families in crisis, and it was very emotionally demanding. And it was also physically demanding. I was having to walk around a lot of Westminster into people's homes. I was carrying heavy laptops. It was just a very demanding demanding job in a lot of ways. And I think because I wasn't happy in it, it meant that I was exercising too much. I was going out too much. I was probably drinking too much. All those things to try and mask the fact that it wasn't working for me. So yeah, that was a really big instigator. I think I probably, had I not got that particular job, I probably would have carried on going. But it was that was really probably the straw that broke the camel's back.
And then, as I remember it, when you first started getting kind of real symptoms, it unraveled quite quickly in my memory. Just kind of talk us through kind of what happened.
So I broke my ankle. It was a very weird situation. I'd sort of had this mantra running through my head of, I just want to break. I was so tired. I was doing far too much. And I missed the bottom step and I broke my ankle.
You got a break.
I got a break. I literally got the break I'd been asking for. And went to A&E. They did a scan. They didn't notice anything. I knew that something had happened. I'd heard the crack. It was pretty obvious. So I went to a specialist who said, but I had something called a snowboarder's fracture, which they only generally see in really high impact accidents like snowboarding, where just the whole of my inside of my ankle was just crushed. And when I told him that it had been the fact that I'd missed a bottom step, he just couldn't believe that I created that much damage. So it really was an extraordinary injury to get. And so I had to have an operation to remove bits of bone, which was nice. And I went back to work quite quickly afterwards, hopping around London. And it was very strange. I started to get a cough, and then I had pain in my lungs, and I was starting to get really emotional. I couldn't figure out what was going on, and I kept going to my GP, and he was suggesting maybe I should go on antidepressants. And I was so lost and confused at the time that it kind of made sense. I thought, I'll give it a go. I actually didn't, but the symptoms were just getting worse and worse and worse. And I was going in and out of A&E, and they kept doing CT scans and saying, there's nothing wrong with you, go home. And this was all in a very sort of extraordinary time over Christmas and New Year.
I vaguely remember going to some of those appointments with you.
Yeah, oh, you did. You definitely carried me into A&E a few times. And I eventually again went to a specialist literally on Christmas Eve, who did a whole load of MRI, different tests. And I didn't get any of the results until the 4th of January when everything started back up again. And those test results came back with two collapsed lungs, fractured rib, blocked bronchial tubes, pleurisy, fluid on the lungs. I mean, everything that could have gone wrong had gone wrong. And it was just a strange time because none of it had been picked up in A&E. My doctor kept suggesting antidepressants. And then it was the start of this mind game that you go through when you've got a chronic illness, when you know that something's wrong, but everyone professional around you sort of saying, maybe not, maybe it's just psychological. So that was the very start of all of that madness. And I think the only sanity I had was you in that process, who could see from word go that it was signs of burnout and stress. And as a result, I think once I'd sort of recovered, well, not even recovered, but once I knew what the damage was, the first thing you said to me is, you got to quit your job. Come live with me and your sister. We'll get you back on your feet after 3 months. And that's what I did. And I think, you know, I don't know how I could have ever gone back to work in the state I was in. So it was great.
I mean, it was an interesting time as well, because I remember having personally seen hundreds, if not thousands of cases, of kind of reading kind of cases of people, kind of the build up to getting chronic fatigue, burnout, you know, Lyme, whatever the kind of the diagnosis becomes, that there is always that kind of loads on a boat and kind of build up of things. It seemed clear that was happening. And then at the same time, I was like, I don't want to project kind of my world view onto what's happening. Like, normally I would see people, you know, 6 months, a year, a few years, decade or whatever down the line, where it's become clear that's kind of what's going on. But it was, I remember thinking, well, you know, we were moving house at the time, and we were moving into a house that was, because we were about to have another child, a bit bigger than we were going to need immediately. And I remember saying to Tanya, my wife, your sister, that I was like, I just don't think this is going to pass quickly. This doesn't feel like it's a month, go on holiday for a month and rest and get better. Like, it just felt more complicated and more kind of facets. But I also didn't think it was going to be as complicated as it was, which we'll also come to as a story, story unfolds. So then this would bring us up until, I guess, April that year that we moved house and you moved in. And I think initially, I think everyone's expectation was it was just going to be a case of taking a sustained period of rest and time and taking away some of the kind of pressures of kind of work and life. And then things would start to kind of bounce back from there. And that obviously wasn't really quite what happened.
No. And I still don't think I know what happened, but it just... So I guess the physical aspect of what had gone wrong in my lungs had healed to a point, but the fatigue kicked in, the nervous symptoms were getting worse, the immune system was getting worse. And so that's when I think I started working with the nutritionist and I think I'd been working with the psychologist a bit before anyway, but definitely the nutritionist, we sort of kicked it up then. And then just working really hard. I sort of, anything that anyone ever suggested to me, or skin brushing, or, you know, tongue scraping, or whatever it was, I tried everything. I cleaned up my diet. I pretty much followed any and every recommendation that came my way, which was amazing. I learned a lot in the process and it was good, but at the same time, it kept on going and it kept on going and kept on going.
And I remember somewhat arrogantly thinking at the time, it's like, oh, well, Violet's getting the premium products. Like she's coming to look at us. It's like she's got, you know, I know you went and did the 90-day program. You went and did nutrition work. And I was very clear, like, I am not your practitioner. And you were very clear, you are not my practitioner. Like I was there as your brother-in-law and friend as a support and a kind of, you know, hopefully at times kind of wise voice, but I wasn't the one that was kind of working as the practitioner. But I remember kind of thinking, well, it's going to be longer than she thinks. It's probably going to be 6 to 12 months, but it's yeah. just going to be a gradual kind of upwards kind of curve along that way. That wasn't what happened. And we'll come to that a bit more in a minute, but there was some initial improvement, I think, wasn't there? There was some kind of help in terms of calming down some of the, there was a stabilization, let's say, that I think happened, but there wasn't perhaps the improvement that was expected.
Yeah, I think the acute phase passed and it sort of went on to a more sort of flat line in some ways, but a steady flat line. But actually looking back on it now, or thinking about it now, I was nowhere ready for recovery, for everything that I've gained as a result now. I wasn't ready at the time. I needed those 3 years. I know that sounds mad, but I needed those 3 years to get to what I've achieved now. So I'm sort of grateful in some ways. And I'm sorry to you that you had to put up with me for all that time, but I learned a lot in the process.
That's all right. I've bad-mouthed you beautifully in the carers interviews. I'm teasing. I think, you know, what I actually said was that it was challenging for all of us. It was challenging the fact that we were kind of in this, particularly that Tanya and I were very much at that stage of one kind of, two-year-old, I guess, one's being born kind of around that time, that we were kind of home a lot. And it was quite intense, but it was also amazing, like in terms of yours and my kind of connection. You'd been in Australia when Tanya and I had met, and basically we met the first times on the phone. And by the time I met you in person, we were basically like, we're having a kid, we're getting married, hi.
Yeah.
Exactly. it was also kind of gifts that kind of came from it as well. But there, so then we're in that kind of period, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think if we bring in the kind of other aspect of this story in terms of the kind of creative pieces that came in, but I think one of the earlier pieces was it cooking or was it essential oils, which was the first piece that was?
First thing was the cream. So I was making natural body products, sort of face and body products, because I'd cleaned up the diet. I just wanted to not put any extra stress on my body. And I went into shops to buy face cream, body cream, whatever it was, shower gel. And I would look at the back and the ingredients, and I just, half of it I didn't understand, but I knew that it wasn't exactly what my body was needing. So I researched and started testing out and just making all my own natural products with purely sort of healthy ingredients, and I absolutely loved it. And I got to the point where I started making it for people to sell, and it was a very, very small income, but it was just a sense of achievement that I got from it. And
you were really accepted. And you were pretty much housebound at that point, right? So you were buying the various things, you were buying like the kind of containers, and you were buying the ingredients and stuff online, and you were kind of doing it in your bedroom, the attic of our house, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And it was very much, I remember that I would have to book out with you guys certain hours where I could have like use of the kitchen, because I couldn't handle, my nervous system was so sensitive, I couldn't handle noise when I was trying to focus. And so it was amazing when I was doing my art, I was sort of upstairs, I could lock myself away. But when I was in the kitchen making my creams, it was just, I had to have that time completely quiet, because by the time I'd done a few hours of making the cream, I was absolutely exhausted. It sounds mad now, but you know, just even stirring the cream was enough to make me exhausted. So I would, have a few days in bed after that. But it was amazing. It was really sort of using my hands, the smell. That it used all my body senses, so it was an amazing process. It was going back to nature.
And I remember there was quite a contrast at the time, because there was the fact that you were more sick than you were expecting, in some ways more sick than I was expecting as well. But you also had this kind of creative outlet and this kind of way that you were also connecting to the world via that you were kind of making these products and friends and family and stuff were kind of experiencing it. But just coming then back to the kind of recovery story piece, I think it was around this point. So I probably, I guess, were maybe a year in, kind of 9 months, a year in or something at this point. And I remember kind of thinking, this is kind of odd. Like, this is taking a bit longer. And I remember, I remember particularly, it was a little more awkward at Christmas that year. And I was like seeing like your kind of dad and various people, how's Violet doing? And I'd kind of said like 6-9 months early, well, I think she needs a good 6 months to a year. And it was, and it was like, I was relatively kind of new to the family at this point. And I was like, it's
going to be a little bit longer. Sorry, I put you through that.
It's an interesting kind of learning process. And so what was going on for you at that point? Because it must have been, you know, at that point, you'd made some significant adjustments in your life and you'd kind of given up a lot of independence and kind of freedom that suddenly you're kind of relatively housebound, although you were sometimes going and staying with kind of family and stuff, but relatively housebound. In an area of North London, you didn't really know people and you're kind of isolated from kind of friends. And yeah, what was that like for you at that time?
It was interesting when you just said, you know, 9 months, a year later, what was happening? And I just have no idea. All I can remember really was just being really lost and confused. I mean, the emotional pain was like nothing I've ever experienced in my life. It was so physically painful, the emotion. But at the same time, I can't imagine what it would be like to be surrounded by friends and family who don't understand. Well, I can because I had some that didn't. But I was just held in this kind of this ball of cotton wool by you guys. You were just so amazing with me because you understood it. Tanya has just an abundance of empathy. And so it was amazing. And I felt like you always had my corner. You could always say to family who were starting to question what actually is going on here, you always had my back. You could sort of say to them, back off. You know, she's doing what she needs to do in her own time. And we're working on it kind of thing. So I had a pretty comfortable ride in terms of that.
I wouldn't call it a ride comfortable.
I know, but it also gave me the space to be able to completely lose my mind in some sense. And again, in hindsight, I think I needed that. I needed to lose it to refind what was right.
Well, I think in some ways the there were a few lessons for me, and we'll come to some of the other ones in a bit. But one of the lessons for me at that point was that I kind of mentioned that I'm used to seeing people further down that recovery path. So I'm kind of more used to seeing people where the falling apart's kind of happened and someone's had the bed rest and the physical rest and they're kind of ready for the next stage of that healing process. And my assumption had been that we could just bypass that part of the healing process by the fact that we were getting the right things in kind of very early on in the process. And what I discovered, I have seen cases where that's happened, but what I kind of discovered was that actually that doesn't necessarily work, that there is an innate wisdom and there's a process that people need to go through and people can get stuck in that process. You can sometimes accelerate that process. And often when people come to Optum Health Clinic, they've gone through perhaps what we would call stage one into early stage two, but they're now stuck there. And that's where often there's a lot you can do to start to move that forwards. But you can't fast track. And, you know, in a sense, the fact that I knew quite a bit about it and I'd helped a lot of people and I'd been through it didn't change the fact that your body and your kind of emotional body was going through a necessary process.
Yeah, exactly.
That was a kind of lesson for me and you know, humbling in a good way, in a sense.
Good. Well, I'm pleased you got something positive out of it.
so let's then come back to the art piece, because I don't want to impose my memory of my timelines on you, but my memory was that this was the point where you started doing a bit more in terms of the kind of drawing side of the art. And I remember at the time, you helped design the Optum Health Clinic logo. And at that point, I knew you were doing some drawing in your bedroom. I was like, basically the designer that was doing it, I was just getting so frustrated that it just didn't look right. And I said, can you help? It was kind of like a moment of desperation. And it's like a day or two later, I was like, oh shit, Violet can draw. It was basically my kind of reaction.
I had that reaction too.
So there was, we'll build up to the reaction to the kind of the infamous kind of in my world, kind of the lady drawing that still hangs in our kind of living room in our new house kind of since then. But in the kind of build up to that, what was the point where you, I know you've drawn a little bit kind of, but not in any way seriously before, but yeah, well, just talk us through the how that came in and how it came about.
Do you know what? I think it was a lot of people saying to me, have you tried drawing? It's very therapeutic. And I literally think that was it. I know my mum has always bugged me about it. And, you know, I had that teenage reaction to begin with, like, no, leave me alone. You know, I'll do what I want to do. And I think there was just one day where it happened. And I decided, because I was working out of my bedroom and because I was sick and I was wanting to reduce all toxicity, there was only a few mediums that I could actually use to work with that weren't toxic. I couldn't work with oils in my bedroom or even acrylic. So I really only had the choice of watercolors and charcoal. So I think I just ordered some of that from Amazon and just started sort of tinkering away. And I love the watercolors, but it just didn't sort of seem to fit. And the first piece I did was the woman you just mentioned that I gave to you to say thank you. And it was amazing. It was just the minute detail that I was putting into it. Just, I got completely lost and it would take me away from everything. And, you know, they say that kind of meditative process reduces stress, anxiety, you know, helps with depression. And I definitely found that I could spend hours up there. You know, I remember thinking, oh my God, it's nearly dinner time, but I'm just I'm a million miles away and just enjoying being there. So it was, that was what sort of kickstarted it.
I mean, maybe we can, I'm going to preempt what we can do in post-production, but maybe we can put a scan of the, I know you've got a scan of the piece. Maybe we can put it on screen. Yeah. People can see. But hopefully we can, and if we can't, it's hard to explain how staggeringly detailed this piece is. And it's like, it's enormous as well. Like it's not like a small piece of art. Like it's a big old, like, kind of like, kind of feature piece that hangs in the kind of in the living room. But it's like, it's enormous and it's staggeringly beautiful, staggeringly detailed. And it's like, I know you're going to get shy and embarrassed, but it like is genuinely, like, for me, it was like I don't know what the time scale was. Maybe it was like a 3 or 4 month period or something, from, oh yeah, Violet can draw because she did the thing for the logo for Optum Health Clinic, to like this thing that's presented to me from, I think it was my birthday. I can't quite remember what it was, but it was presented. And I just remember being like, what? I don't understand. I don't understand. Violet's just like doing like her art thing in her room. Like what? I was completely and utterly staggered by it.
So part of it for me was escapism. So when I was drawing, I could focus on what I felt passionate about. You know, it was positive things as opposed to the sort of hardcore social work I've been doing before. But also I was so sensitive and still am really sensitive to other people's energy. So I was able to sort of hide away and do that. And I think one of the biggest things for me was I was doing it for myself and not for anyone else. So no, I wouldn't really show anyone. I know Tanya would sometimes not push down the door to try and come in and see what I was doing, but it was not my sort of intention for it to be seen. It was my own personal little safe space, my thing. Hence why I sort of worked up in my room and didn't really show you what I was doing.
Yeah, I was like, what? And then we'll track back to the recovery piece in a minute, but what was also kind of, I remember pretty quickly going, can I like commission you to do something for my friend who's one of the kids' godfathers? I don't think I actually ever paid you for it, by the way.
No, it was £10. I think it was going to be, wasn't it?
You wouldn't take my money. And I remember when we presented it to him, and he fell on his. It was a teacher of his from many, many years ago. He's a Buddhist teacher, and it was in his 20s. He'd gone and lived with this teacher in the Himalayas, and so we managed to get a photo from a friend, and you drawn from that. And he literally fell on his knees and wept. He was so like blown away by this piece. And then a bit further down the line, another friend of mine saw the piece. You did, can I commission Violet? So I felt like I loved the fact that it wasn't just kind of Tanya and I that were being impacted, but people were coming in to our home or seeing things, and it was kind of something was kind of building from that. But I'm also wondering, what was happening for you at that time? Like, as you kind of were starting to get some early kind of reactions and recognition, but you were also still pretty sick at that point. How was that for you?
I just still think I was really determined that I wasn't gonna, it was never gonna be a career or anything. I was sort of doing the piece for your friend to as another way of thanking you. And that was as far as it was going to go. I was so adamant that I didn't think the work that I was producing was any good to show, but I also knew that it was my own private and personal thing, that if I started to sell it or do it for other people, that it would just change the whole dynamic of what I was getting from drawing, which was just peace. And I knew that if I had that pressure, there'd be more stress involved,
right,
which I was trying to reduce.
Can you say a bit more about what the kind of creative process was like in terms of, I know you were saying it was like a way of kind of escaping, a way of having peace, say a bit about how that helped you in terms of the emotional and physical healing journey that you were on at that time.
Yeah, so I think the minute detail for me was a place that I could just escape to. So even though I might have been drawing a big elephant, you know, within those tiny, tiny little sort of markings on its skin, or the folds of its skin or its ears, had its own sort of drawing within itself. You know, every kind of millimeter was its own drawing. And so it just meant I could just go deeper and deeper into that. And it was just a way to focus my mind on something positive and away from the negativity of health. I think I struggled a little bit in terms of, could I sit up that day? Could I use my arm? So there would only, some days I couldn't draw at all. Some days it was only just a little bit. But there was a sense of achievement that came with anything that I did. You know, so I'd have the piece in my room and I would see it all the time. You know, I'd wake up in the night and it would be there and it would give me a fright. I'd be like, oh my God, I've got a gorilla in my room. What's going on? But there was definitely sort of a sense of achievement, because although I didn't think it was good enough to sell or anything, I knew that it was making me happy, and I knew that the reactions from the few people that were seeing it were positive. So it was really fulfilling in that sense.
I think it's also worth saying that these pieces they're large and they're very intricate, particularly this time of your work. And they were months, right, to create one piece. It wasn't like a kind of week or two. It was like so there must have been something also about cultivating kind of patience, and kind of you couldn't get too fixated on kind of completion because it was such a long process to create a piece.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I don't think I ever necessarily thought of that at the time, because there was no time limit. And I think that was what was so precious about it. You know, I felt lucky enough that I could live with you guys. There was never that pressure for me to be able to have to earn to survive. And I just, I'm so thankful for that, because I appreciate that there's a lot of people out there that do have to do that. And art is probably one of the hardest ways to earn money anyway. But because there was no time pressure, there was no pressure of anything of any sort other than to keep doing it, you know, in my own time, it was just so healthy. It was just, everything around it was positive. So it was brilliant.
So let's then come back to your kind of recovery journey. So this, what point, I mean, I should say as a kind of steering of where we're going for people, that it became clear that there was more than just a kind of a burnout kind of classic kind of chronic fatigue picture. That it became clear that you also had Lyme, and there was a whole other kind of path that opened up. I forgive my memory. I'm trying to remember how that came about. It wasn't me. I think it might have been Julia that you're working with.
It was Julia. So we were going through, I think we got to that point where I'd started saying, okay, I've done this. I've been doing everything by the book for, I think it was probably about 18 months, 2 years at that point. Yeah. And I was saying, okay, I remember a lot of the feedback I get from you guys and the family was, I'd say, it's not enough. Like, something else has got to happen. Was, you are improving, you really are. It's just, you're such a perfectionist, you want it to be faster, and it's happening, but it's happening really slow. And actually, I've never asked you this, was that genuinely what you thought? Or, do you know what I mean? I'm putting it back on you, but it felt to me like I needed to start saying, okay, something else needs to come into this.
It is what I genuinely thought for quite a while, because the progress was very slow. I don't mean that as a judgment. It just kind of objective.
No, it
compared to like what I expected to be, it was slow.
Yeah.
But it was there. Like, the classic signs of your lows weren't as low as they had been. They weren't lasting quite as long as your highs were a little bit higher. They lasted a bit longer. There were more of them. But you were still relatively housebound. Like, you were still kind of like, it was still kind of a, like, if we would go and you'd go and stay with family, it was still like, a journey, like, to get there. Like, you know, that I would
have to take me.
I would drive you, or Tanya would, or they'd drive you back. Yeah. Like, it wasn't like you were limited in your energy, but kind of living your life. Like, you were not getting back into life, if that makes sense.
I remember sort of going out for dinner with friends. I mean, this was probably once every 3 months or something, and it would floor me for weeks after. So I just have to make sure, or I just have to prepare myself that was the sacrifice I was going to make if I wanted to feel normal. And going out for dinner, and it was just like, oh my God, this is the world. This is what people do. This is what was normal for me before. And it's so exciting. And then I'd hit a certain point at sort of 9:30 in the evening. I'd be like, I've got to go home now. I can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
But it was, yeah. So that was definitely at that time there was improvement in that I was getting out a bit more. I think I was going up to the shops myself. I had a car so I could drive myself up there and pick up any kind of products that I needed or whatever. But it just felt deeply frustrating that I just was so far from a normal life.
And I know there were a few conversations, and I don't remember the exact sequence, but I know there were a few conversations where you said to me, I feel like there's something missing. And I think there was a point where I was like, yes, I think you're right. I think there is something missing. And I know that I had a few conversations with, obviously with your blessing, with Julia and with Jess, and kind of like, is there anything we're missing? What else is going on here? What could it be? And it kind of comes back a little bit as we talk about it. I think it was Julia said, well, let's look at Lyme. And I think you then had some tests with Armin Lab, I think it was in Germany, that then came back. And I think it was a bit inconclusive from my memory, that there were some co-infections that were there. It wasn't, do you remember what?
So they, I mean, I think it was a process of elimination. So it wasn't necessarily a positive, but it suggested the levels of my immune system.
Yeah, antibodies, yeah.
Yeah. That was what was coming back, alluding to the fact that it was probably Lyme disease.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember it wasn't it wasn't that clear, but I remember there was like, it looks like there's kind of something that's kind of going on here. And then that started a whole other kind of phase. And I think this is where the next bit in terms of kind of, you know, lessons, it's not meant to be Alex's confessional lessons on the one of the lessons that came for me was that I didn't know that much about Lyme disease at that point. And Oxfam Health Clinic knew more than I did, because obviously my primary work is on the psychology side and I have some oversight of the nutrition department, but not on a technical level. And so there, we knew more than I did, quite a lot more than I did, it would be hard, but we didn't know anything like as much as we do now. And it was one of the cases, and there were a bunch of cases, but it was obviously what was the case closest to my heart, which was from my point of view, are kind of like, what else can we learn? What do we need to do? So you then went off and added in some, saw some other people, added some other pieces, which became a source of kind of learning and kind of information. I'm wondering, what was that like for you at that point to get a new level of clarity and a sense of, oh, hang on, this actually explains some of these other pieces of the picture that didn't feel so understood at that point?
Well, I remember, you know, the amount of tests that I was doing, and every time they come back, oh, you're within normal range. And I just remember by the time I did the Lyme test, I was like, please, I was praying for it to come back positive, which is crazy now I think about it. And it came back with a potentially positive result. And I just remember thinking, you've got to be careful what you wish for. This is terrifying. Because, you know, anything that I looked online said that chances of recovery are pretty slim. And, you know, all the different methods out there that were being poo-pooed. And it was a scary place to be. And I think that was the first time where I got a sense of what it would be like if I'd got ill without you being there, that it's suddenly like, oh my God, there's this big world out there. And where do I start? Who do I go to? What do I trust? What do I do? But it was, we found someone pretty quickly. I remember I was going to go to America to do Klinghart, and we found one of his practitioners who happened to live about three streets up.
It was so funny. It was like, I can't, people would not believe it if they saw it on the map, how close you was. And actually Klinghart is one of the interviews on this conference. So if people want to know about Klinghart's protocol, they can listen to that interview. But anyway, go on. So
I started that, and I was having quite strong Herx reactions from some of the treatment. I felt like I was going too quickly and it was too strong. There was a whole lot of other things. I was having to travel to Germany for cryotherapy, and I can't remember, there's a whole load of things that they wanted me to do. And after about 6 months, my dad's business partner sort of got downwind of the fact that I had Lyme disease and said that his best friend had been cured, by a doctor in Belgium. And that's when I went on a whole new journey. And within the first sort of few days of being out on that treatment, it was very clear something was shifting. I mean, it was so clear. And I remember thinking that during the time we were saying, okay, there's something not, you know, there's something else going on here. I remember what was going around in my head was, I feel infected. I just feel so infected. It was that was what was so the thing that was singing out to me the most. And when I started the treatment in Belgium on day two or day three, I had a certain treatment that again brought out the Herxheimer reactions. And the next day I woke up and it was the first time in what three and a half years that I didn't feel infected. It was unbelievable. It was so clear. And I think that was a time that made me realize how much we've got to listen to our bodies and our intuition and fight for it in some ways. And not just, that it would necessarily have changed my journey, but it was very clear. Yeah. I got that confirmation.
Absolutely. And I think also, just to kind of bring it back to the story unfolding. So this was around this time we were moving house. We'd bought a house and we'd spent the last year doing renovations on it. And we were moving into the new house, and Tanya and I, it was just a complete, we were just like, assuming, like, well, obviously Violet's coming too. And so, but I remember the bedroom options in the new house weren't as good as the old house. In the old house, there was this kind of granny flat on the top floor, which just was like kind of perfect in a sense. And then in the new house, it was basically the basement, which is nice, but it's not quite the same. Not quite the same artist's light, let's say, as what you had before. Or this kind of room on the kind of landing that if we were going to have a third kid, probably was going to be there, which we did in the end, would have been their room. But it was kind of in the middle of the house and not that big and quite noisy. And like, I remember thinking, well, it's going to be tricky, but obviously, you know, we'll make it work. And then I think you felt that you'd made enough progress, just about. I think it was a bit borderline, but enough progress, just kind of enough. You're like, actually, I also want to move on. And I think it wasn't immediately, but in time, you then ended up getting your own place. So there was some progress, and there was some change over that time. I think a lot of inner kind of emotional work that kind of shifted, but physically things weren't. And I remember, I think you probably felt, and I felt, you left. I was like, I wish we'd got you that kind of bit further. And then it was a lot happened. So one could argue that it all got better when you moved out from us.
It was literally the timing that I went to Belgium was when I'd literally just moved out, I think. And so, yeah, it all happened very quickly, but I also think it was all meant to be, you know, that was the shift that was right.
And I also wonder, we'll never know the answer to this, but I wonder if you'd been able to tolerate the Belgian work, or if it would have been effective if you hadn't done the work that you'd done leading up to that. But we'll never know the answer to that question.
Yeah. And I'm always very scared of different therapies that say that, you know, if you learn this breathing technique, you will be cured of your Lyme disease. If you do that, you know, there's a lot of different therapies out there that make these grand promises. And I've always been really shy of that. And I can't remember what we were talking about.
We were talking about whether the preparation had been necessary. I think.
So things like, you know, my diet, even though I cleaned it up, I was sort of getting messages from, particularly online, that had, if I'd cleaned up my diet and if I did follow these certain sort of diets, that it would get me better. And I remember that sense of frustration of, I have been doing this to the T for the last, you know, 18 months, 2 years, and it hasn't. You know, this was all part of that interesting process of, I'm doing everything, but it's not changing. And sorry, I forgot.
So I know what you're going to point. The point is that it wasn't that each thing was necessary, I think, for a certain.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes, yes. So without the diet, I wouldn't have had that foundation that I would have been in the prime position for that treatment to have come in and worked. So it was everything I'd done had got me in the perfect place for it.
So then you went off and you did that work, and that was a bumpy ride at times, but it was also clearly significant in terms of the progress that you made. Tell us how the kind of creative piece was evolving at this point.
Well, so I was still drawing, again, no intention to do anything with it. And my mother and my other sister very naughtily went off behind my back and took some of my artwork to a gallery and said, do you think you could do anything with this? And he said that he liked my work and he wanted it to be in a show in sort of 2 months' time. I think it was 2 months after that. And so they came back and confessed to me, and I thought, got to lose, I might as well give it a go. And I did, and had great sort of positive reception. And it's, I don't know, it just snowballed from there. But it felt like everything was working at the right time and the right speed and the right way. Everything was positive. All the feedback was good. Doors were opening. Everything just felt easy and like it was meant to be. I didn't really have to fight. And for me, that made sense that I've been on this just unbelievably bumpy journey. And I've been to some dark places and done some dark things, that's the reward I was getting, was that life was showing me what was easy and what was right and what was clear. So I sort of went with it, and it's just made for the most amazing career. I've got all my greatest loves being wildlife, travel and drawing, you know, every day in my life. And I've got a career where I can work my own time schedule. Because I'm still sensitive, I need to be able to spend a lot of time on my own. So I can do that when I'm drawing. I can choose my work hours. If I'm having a day where I'm not feeling great, I don't, you know, don't have a boss that I have to answer to, I still work incredibly hard, but it's within my own capabilities and being able to still listen to my body when I need to.
But say a bit more about kind of life now, because you're traveling off to kind of wild and crazy places. And I know you spent a bunch of time in India, kind of. So just kind of run us through some of the kind of travel, because I think for someone that was housebound for a 2.5 year, 3 year kind of period, and people that are watching or listening to this that are still in that phase, that yes, you have some sensitivities, and you have to be a little bit kind of careful around the edges, but you're living a very, very full kind of rich life. So just paint a bit more of a picture of what that's like.
I think a big part of my recovery was actually when I moved to the country. So I knew for me, I needed nature and wildlife. It's something that feeds my soul. And so when I made that move, I think it was 2 years ago, I definitely felt I went up the next notch in terms of recovery. And I think what I've had to do is get my head around expectations of what I'm capable of, whether it means I've got a little bit more on the journey to go in terms of recovery, or just this is who I am, this is what my constitution is, this is what feeds me, this is what depletes me. But I basically, you know, live on my own in a cottage in the middle of the countryside. I have a studio 5 minutes up the road. I have fairly quiet weeks, you know, eating healthy, still not always eating healthy, but most of the time, sleeping well, you know, still do my meditation. And then what it means that I can do is I build up the energy, and then I can go off. You know, last year I was in Papua New Guinea, I was in Kalimantan. I managed to go off and travel and collaborate with these conservation projects. You know, I can do 2 week stints, 3 week stints out there, come back, and often I'm feeling so much better. The sunshine, just the excitement of it all. I need to come back and rest a bit, but generally I can thrive after those trips. And then work towards the exhibitions to sort of donate some of the proceeds back into conservation. So I've got a pretty good life. Weekends are fairly busy. I do still need to be mindful of not booking a lot into my life. And I'm content. I'm happy with that. I was thinking the other day, thinking about this interview and reflecting on things, and I don't think I've ever been this content in my whole life. I look back on the times where there was just this kind of inner turmoil that I used to have. And I just don't have it anymore. You know, I can still have periods of bits of anxiety here or feeling a bit depressed there, but that is on top of a base contentment, which is just, God, I feel so lucky I've been able to get there.
But it's also, it's interesting that the journey has had these different kind of stages. And in a sense, it's like, you did all this preparation, you then had this period where things move forwards quickly, and then there was kind of a steady kind of build kind of for a while, right? That you had this kind of big step forward, and it appears to me that you then went back to some of your fundamentals in terms of, actually, I need to live a life which feeds me and a life that is happy. I need to live in a place that feels, that feeds my soul. I need to spend time around the people which make me feel excited. So those kind of life fundamentals that also had an impact. Maybe say a bit about how constructing your life in a certain way has also been not just about your health recovery, but also about, in a sense, creating a life which is nurturing for you, as opposed to pre all of this being the person you thought you should be. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, totally. I mean, my body is permanently my guide as to what is going on, what I should be doing, what I shouldn't be doing. So if I'm doing too much in terms of being around people too much or the wrong kind of people, I get really clear messages. My body tells me when I need to do yoga. I can feel it the minute I haven't done meditation in the morning. I know that my body's not okay. So I still use my body, still massively my guide. And I think that was, I remember one of the doctors in Belgium saying to me that I don't have the constitution to be a marathon runner. Don't ever expect to be that person. But I see that in all areas. So I'm never going to be someone that is going to be able to work a sort of 7-day week job working for someone else, you know. So I've managed what I know I'm capable of and what makes me happy. And when I start to push that boundary a little bit, I get the feedback quite quickly, and I adapt and change and try and listen as much as I can.
What's your relationship like with your art these days? I mean, it's an interesting thing as well. You make the transition from something that was, I'll just do it as a complete expression, creative play when I feel like it, to now you have to create to a certain schedule, you have to create for exhibitions, you have, you know, sponsors for kind of trips that you have to then kind of have an output from. Like, how have you managed to maintain your kind of your joy and your kind of connectivity in that?
It's been a journey in itself, and I've gone up and down with it. After I did a big trip last year, something in my system just had a complete tantrum and I refused to draw, and I didn't draw for probably about 4 or 5 months. And I think it was because of the pressure. Subconsciously, it was all building up too much. And I think, you know, I had a lot of conversations with artists about this, a lot who used to say, you need to force yourself. You just need to sit down and do it. Even if you don't like what you're producing, just keep going, keep going. And as harsh as that sounds, it actually was for me what really helped. And I think more than anything, I've realized how routine is good for me. So for me, knowing that I go to the studio from 8:39 in the morning till 3 o'clock in the afternoon, that whatever I do in that time doesn't necessarily matter, but I just have to be there. So if I'm having a day that I don't feel particularly creative or good, just as long as I'm there and I'm doing the best I can, that is the best. And I think also having goals, something to work towards, and suddenly bringing in responsibilities, but they're very much under my own direction and my own desire, that having that responsibility means that I am answering to myself. I am getting up. I am, you know, doing stuff, which is helpful. So it's that balance that you need, where there's not too much responsibility. I'm doing it for myself. And also, you know, come on, you got to get up and do stuff.
Would you have ever believed when you first started drawing in the bedroom at the old house on Rosebery Road that you would be sat here now? Because I remember you saying a few times, like, what am I going to do for a career? Where there were quite a lot of existential kind of questions about your life. Would you ever believe that you would be a kind of in-demand successful artist?
No, shush now. I definitely, no way. Absolutely not. It was a very slow drip-fed process of me trying to imagine what I wanted for my future. And I think collaborating with conservation projects was always a number one. I always wanted to work with wildlife, particularly endangered wildlife. And I couldn't necessarily see how that would happen. And so I would never have imagined it, never. And yeah, never a career exposes me so much, exposes my work. I never thought I would be able to do that. But it's just felt so natural and so easy that it's just been clearly the right thing.
I mean, it's almost like how I think about it is a lot of the emotional turmoil you went through in those early few years was kind of you digesting and shedding the layers of kind of who you thought you were kind of prior to that, to get closer to actually who you really are. And in a sense, once you contact that, it's particularly when you've had to make so many compromises for a period of time in your life where you can't do the things you want to do, I think one can become quite, in a good way, quite uncompromising on the other side of that. That it's like, I now have this connection to this thing and I love it, and therefore this is what I'm going to find a way to express in my life.
Yeah, definitely.
What would you, as we kind of thinking last few questions, what would you say to someone that's in the situation that you were in before you had the breakthrough in terms of your health kind of piece, where you'd been incredibly diligent in terms of, you know, there was never a time where I thought, well, Violet just needs to get her shit together and work harder on the tools. And I mean, you know my character, you know how I am when I'm kind of just, and I'm not being kind of me in my kind of professional role. I'm quite uncompromising. I'm quite kind of pushy, and I'm quite kind of like, shit needs to get done. And I can be quite punchy and direct with patients sometimes where I feel like they're not serving themselves. I never felt that way towards you. And there must have been times that you were, I'm sure, were very frustrated about the amount of work that was going in when the output was felt small, even though in a sense things leap forward partly because of that work, even if it was just the emotional work supporting your kind of creative kind of burst. But what would you say to someone that's kind of in that place where they're putting a lot of work in and it feels like things are not moving forwards and they feel frustrated and kind of like they want to give up and they feel just kind of resigned to the fact that it's just things aren't going to change? What would you have wanted to hear at that time, or what would you say to someone in that place?
Trust that things will work out in their own time, in their own way. I think in hindsight, it's easy for me to say that now, but if someone said that to me at the time, it's like, yeah, but I feel like I need to do more. Like I always felt like, you know, maybe if I don't do that one thing that's been suggested to me, that it will be the thing that slips through the cracks or means that I don't get better. And I think that as long as you're doing the best you can, you've got to listen to your body, listen to your intuition, and listen to the signs you're getting. And just trust it'll work out in its own time and in its own way, which is easy for me to say now, but that was my experience of healing. I was so deeply frustrated that things weren't moving. So I think if I'd been able to say to myself, you've got these 3 years where you're sick, or these 5 years where you're sick, choose how you're going to deal with it. You can either be deeply frustrated and angry and whatever, or you can just accept that that is the time you are being given to do all the things that you need to do to explore yourself, and all of this will come good and have benefit in the end. Again, I don't know if I would have necessarily believed it if someone said that to me, but that's what I would like to say to myself 5 years ago.
And people, just to complete the story, sadly, the doctor you saw in Belgium passed away a year or two ago. People might be asking about that. Would have been great to have her as part of the conference. Is there anything that you want to share in terms of on a more kind of physical level, in terms of how you kind of work with the Lyme piece, or any of the kind of key messages or key tips from that?
I think I've lost you. On the physical level, so what I was doing physically. So
yeah.
I think, like, very much it was following on from OHC, in that it was very holistic. So in Belgium, I worked with a medical doctor, an alternative doctor, a body worker, and a psychologist. And for me, I would never want to do any treatment that wasn't incorporating all of those areas. And then I think, yeah, it was listening to my gut and sort of having a conversation with all the doctors at all the time, saying that doesn't feel right for me, or that does feel right, or yes, you know, listening to them and knowing that they might know better than me, but also knowing that my body is something that they don't know as well as me. So I think it's just the holistic approach, being open to everything, but also if you know that your gut instinct saying no, I can't do that, then that's saying that for a reason. What might work at one time might not work at another time, vice versa. So there was certain things that I was doing, you know, early days that were irrelevant that I will incorporate now that are relevant. So it's all listening to feedback, I think, as much as you can, being open-minded.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, you know, in a sense, it was a great gift that you gave to me and gave to Optimum Health Clinic, because there was a whole new learning and evolution for us. And, you know, obviously that always continues. But it was, there's nothing like having one of the people closest to in your life and your family, and it's like, shit ain't going to plan.
I know. It's like, yeah, it must have been so hard for you.
It was much harder for you, but it was certainly, you know, and I've always said Optimum Health Clinic's approach has evolved over the years by a few handfuls of people. Where, I mean, it's evolved because of everyone, but particularly I can track back a few kind of key people where, for whatever reason, things didn't go the way that we would expect. And because, you know, for different reasons, either just we're dogged and refusing to let go, or because we got more emotionally involved in that case, for whatever reason, but that's where things get updated in terms of ideas and protocols.
And I think you can see recovery like that as well, that things that go wrong tell you something. It's sometimes the biggest lessons. And I definitely learned that there was things that went wrong where it was like, woof, okay, you know, that's going to be something that will, that definitely is pinpoints in my recovery as well.
So final question. What would you, I've kind of asked my kind of, what would you say to someone that's kind of at the place you kind of were before? What would you say to someone who's kind of coming through and making progress, but not really clear what they want their life to look like? Because I think that was one of the other big pieces for you, was like taking some control of the process of going, I've made a bunch of decisions up until a previous point in my life where I was doing what I thought I should be doing, or what I thought was kind of the right thing. Yeah, what I guess really what I'm asking is, what gave you the courage to follow your passion? Because I think people either need the courage to dive in and find that, or they have a sense of that and they don't believe that it's something that they can pursue. What gave you the courage to make those choices?
To do it. So I guess it's a two-part thing, you know, and a lot of people have said this to me, even people who haven't been sick, is, you know, I need a career change, or, you know, mothers who are wanting to go back to work and not knowing how to do it. So for me, the first one was exploring lots of different things without the pressure of it being, this is my career. You know, some people can go jump straight back into studying something and maybe jump in too soon. So it's just being able to experiment and try things. So I tried the creams, I was trying cooking and, you know, making my own little cookbooks and things like that. So, but it was the art that really kind of was the one that was very clearly going to carry on. And then the confidence, I feel like it was not something I had to work on. It was something that was naturally there because it felt right. I've definitely had moments of doubt, but I just tend to ignore them. I don't know, somehow I managed to just shut it out and just keep going and just think. I think when you're sick, you it's really clear what's important and what's not. And that's what's brought me a lot of contentment. You know, I often used to try and please other people. And I think the process of being ill made me realize that actually that's not going to do any good for me, that I've got to please myself. And so that has just naturally given me the confidence to just keep going.
So I'm sure people listening to this, there'll be people that want to go and check out your artwork. Your website, you might be too shy, so I'm going to give it, is violetaster.com. People can go there and see your work. Anything you want to say about what's coming up in terms of your kind of upcoming projects?
So at the moment, I was in Amman at the beginning of the year, and I'm collaborating with the Environment Society of Amman and producing a body of work on Amman's endangered species. And that's going to be exhibited at the end of the year in Muscat, which is very exciting. And then a couple of projects, maybe Madagascar next year, maybe Africa. So got lots in the work. And I think another place to stay in touch is through Instagram. And I think I'm at violet.aster. And that's where I constantly update what I'm up to.
And you're trying to get Michi's Instagram better as well.
We'll get you there. Not that I'm any good anyway.
Violet, thank you so much. I really appreciate you telling the story. I remember you said to me a number of years ago that you couldn't wait to be able to do your recovery story. Well, we did it.
I'm here. I can't believe I'm actually there. It actually means a huge amount that I'm here. So it's, and thank you as well.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, you know. Thank you.
Thanks.